You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It can start with trouble walking, maybe some tripping and falling, maybe muscle cramps, unexplained weakness in your hand, or trouble swallowing. And those early signs could result in a diagnosis of amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS. Some call it Lou Gehrig's disease after the famed Yankee slugger. ALS forced him to retire in 1939 when he was just 36, and he died 2 years later. A recent study by researchers at the University of Michigan explores connections between the progression of ALS and organic toxins like pesticides, industrial chemicals, the kinds of toxins that are long-lasting and common in Michigan. Here now is the primary author of this study. He is the director of U of M's ALS clinic. Dr. Stephen Gutman, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me here and talking about this great work that we're doing.
Well, before we talk about the study and your research, explain to us exactly what happens with ALS.
Sure, absolutely. So ALS is a disease of what we call motor neuron cells. And these are cells that are both in our brain and in our spinal cords. And so these brain cells send these wires down to motor neuron cells in our spinal cord that eventually connect to our muscles. They tell us how to move and how to chew, how to swallow, how to breathe. And for reasons that are quite complex and we don't entirely understand at this point, these nerve cells die. And this leads to these progressive symptoms that you had mentioned, trouble with arm and hand function, trouble with leg and foot function, difficulties with breathing and speaking and swallowing. And so it is unfortunately a disease that is progressive and we don't have a cure for it. We're working hard. But right now, we don't have that magic medication that's going to stop or reverse disease.
What's a typical lifespan after diagnosis?
So ALS is a frustrating disease because it's not recognized early. And so most people, from the time they start getting symptoms to the time they're diagnosed, it takes about a year. And that's because you have this very strange onset of symptoms that you just kind of think maybe due to aging or to other things. And so people start thinking, oh, I have carpal tunnel syndrome, or I just have a pinched nerve. And it's only after time, as the symptoms progress, that they start saying, something's going on here. The average survival, or what we say the median survival time from the onset of symptoms, is in this range of 2 to 4 years. And so it is a short period of time. We as physicians who treat ALS have to do everything in our power to really make sure that we're allowing people living with ALS to have a full life and to enjoy life that's in front of them.
I know there are about 5 to 10% of cases that are inherited and about 90 to 95% that are sporadic, which means you really don't know why someone gets this.
Right. And so you are correct. There's about 10% of individuals with ALS have a familial form of disease, meaning that this disease is run in their family or that there's a identifiable gene mutation that leads to disease. The other 90% have what we call sporadic. Now, sporadic doesn't mean not genetic. And I think this is an important concept and really particularly relates to what we're talking about today because it's what we call a polygenic disease. And so basically what this means is that we all have some susceptibility, underlying genetic susceptibility to any form of disease, whether it be high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes, lung cancer. And so it's your genes that kind of push you up a cliff to trigger you for a disease.
Okay.
But then it's your contacts with the environment or your environmental exposures that then push you over the cliff. So what I tell my patients is that it's almost like cigarette smoking and cancer, right? So there are individuals that we know who've smoked forever and they never get cancer. And you're like, how is that possible,
right?
But there are some who they smoke maybe even for a short period of time and they get lung cancer.
Never smoke.
Right.
Yeah.
So they had that susceptibility and it was those environmental triggers that pushed them over the cliff to get the cancer. And so it's the same in ALS. And so this is when we say that 90% of people have the sporadic form of ALS, what we mean by that is that we're trying to identify all these different triggers that prime them to eventually get ALS.
As you say, tip you over the cliff.
Exactly.
So that's what you were trying to answer, those kinds of questions with this study?
Exactly.
And what'd you learn?
So I'll take a step back before we start off and say that we've been doing this research for about 10 years. So under the direction of Dr. Eva Feldman, she really started what we call the biorepository of our patients. And so what we did was we began to collect exposure histories from our patients who are coming in to see us. And in addition, also collecting samples of biofluids, so blood and urine samples, that allowed us to help begin to understand what are the exposures that one may have had that maybe primed them to getting disease, and also had the ability to measure exposures, whether it be through blood or through urine. And one of the things that we reported on a couple years ago was the levels of what we call these persistent organic pollutants in blood from people with ALS compared to those with healthy controls. We were interested in these POPs, as we call them, these persistent organic pollutants, because these are chemicals that have been manufactured for various purposes. The three categories that we focused on are pesticides, what we call the organochlorine pesticides. They're, for the most part, no longer in use around the world, with a few exceptions. What we call polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs. These had functions in industrial applications. They were used in electrical equipment and additives and paint
and they wound up in cattle feed and got into the food chain in Michigan.
So I won't talk about the PBB story, but absolutely. And then the third class are the brominated flame retardants, or the PBDEs. And these were materials that some are currently in use and some have been banned in the United States in the early 2000s to help reduce the flame properties of materials or make them less combustible.
Okay, so when you examined the patients all these samples, these folks, these patients tended to have a higher amount of these chemicals?
Yep. So in our publication a couple of years ago, which we published in JAMA Neurology, what we saw is in our individuals that have ALS compared to those that do not, they had higher amounts of the PCBs and the PBDs as well, but particularly the pesticides. And so one of the questions we had was, okay, we're seeing that these chemicals seem to influence one's risk or likelihood of getting ALS. But does the story stop there, right? So does it matter that you have these chemicals in you and then once you have them, is the story over? Or can these chemicals lead to some ongoing effect on disease? So what we did was we looked at all of these pollutants together and we said, we think that it's not just one of these pollutants that matters, but a combination of them that influence disease or have some impact on the way disease progresses. And we divided our group up into quartiles and we compared the group that had the lowest levels of pollutants compared to the group that had the highest levels of these pollutants in blood. And essentially those individuals that had the highest amounts or concentrations of all of these pollutants in their blood had a mortality rate of twice that of the lowest group. So they were dying at twice the rate of the group that had the lowest level. And that worked out to about 6 months or so. It wasn't statistically significant that 6 months because we had to adjust for some ALS progression factors.
But it tells you something, that the presence of these toxins can affect the progression of the disease.
Absolutely. And so that is one of the things that we need to further understand. So we're showing an association here, and we're saying that these toxins have some association with the progression of disease. And now we have to dig deeper to understand what are they doing at a mechanism level to these brain cells, to these nerve cells, to make disease progress.
Now, you're studying patients, clearly, coming to your clinic, so we're talking about people in Michigan. We know Michigan has one of the highest rates of ALS in the country, according to the CDC. And then you stop and you think Michigan has 69 designated Superfund cleanup sites. Michigan's industrial activities place it among the top five generators of hazardous waste in the U.S. We had the PCB issue. So do you see this being connected?
So we think so. We're wondering why, as you mentioned, Michigan has some of the highest prevalence rates in the United States, so it's highest in the Midwest. And Michigan has a very large number of Superfund sites, so these sites identified by the EPA as needing to be cleaned up. We rank higher than states like Texas in terms of the number of Superfund sites. I think I saw that California has 98. We have in the high 60s. And higher than the other surrounding states like Ohio, Illinois, Indiana. So we're polluted, unfortunately. We have the Great Lakes, which are wonderful, but they also are a reservoir, unfortunately, for some of these chemicals as they run off or as they've been put into the rivers and eventually the lakes, and they get trapped there. And because they break down so slowly, we believe we have these ongoing exposures. And the other factor is that we're looking at a large number of chemicals, and so we have to understand how do we relate them all together in a model.
And so does this research start pointing you down a road that could lead you to better, more effective treatments for ALS?
So I think it's going to lead us down the road to do two things. One is we hope treatments, but we also have an opportunity to identify a modifiable disease risk factor. And so for ALS, up until this point, we don't really have anything that I can tell my patients or their loved one or family members to say, if you don't do this, it's going to lessen your chance of getting ALS. It's not like the cigarette smoking as we were referring to earlier, right? So if you stop smoking, your likelihood of getting lung cancer is going to decrease tremendously. So we don't have that. So that's number one. If we can identify really key toxins that drive not only susceptibility but progression in ALS, it's possible that we can target a modifiable disease risk. Now, the second item, what you referenced, is that if we can really understand mechanistically how these toxins act at the level of these brain cells, are there targets there that we can drug? So can we say that this enzyme or this metabolite seems to be increasing in response to this exposure, and can we interfere with that target and essentially come up with a new drug for ALS? And that's one of the other things we're focused on. We also need to understand, how do these toxins play a role with genetics, as I alluded to earlier? And are there particular genetic factors that maybe increase one's susceptibility to certain toxins? So we're interested in all three of these, and we're pursuing grants and other things to help us be able to study each of these three things.
Tell me if I'm wrong, but I believe I'm hearing you saying it's still too early to be able to say to people, if you do A, B, or C, you may minimize your chances of developing ALS, or are you at a point where you can say that?
So we have not proven causality. And so as a scientist, I think it's always important for me that we haven't proven causality. And so as excited as we are about seeing these findings, I can't say that this is a definite cause. And we have to understand that interplay between the genetics and between the environment to know what's, again, leading us up the cliff and then pushing us over the edge. However, I think we all understand that a lot of these toxins are probably not protective. They're probably not beneficial for you. And so ways of reducing your likelihood of perhaps ingesting or coming into contact with these toxins is a good idea. But I can't promise anyone at this point that if you do that, your likelihood of getting a disease is less.
So this is scientific research. It is like peeling an onion, mm-hmm. isn't it? You've peeled through a few layers. There are many more layers to go as you work through.
So I use that exact analogy with my patients. And so a lot of these things in neurology are like peeling back the layers of the onion. And the diseases are complex and coming up with solutions are complex. And we do need to peel back these different layers.
Well, more questions to be answered with research. The study has been published in the Journal of Neurology, Neurosurgery, and Psychiatry, as we've talked with primary author Dr. Stephen Gautman, who's director of the ALS Clinic at the University of Michigan. Thank you for sharing your work with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be able to speak on behalf of our great team doing this research.